on Saturday, the 19th. With us, we have Senator Green, Senator Stevens, Huggins, Wilikowski, and my good friend Tom Wagner from Kena, Senator. Excused are Senator McGuire and Senator Stedman. Today, we're going to begin the first chapter of discussing tax regimes on the march towards setting Alaska's new tax regime for gas as required. And to do that, we have with us, there will be three presenters today, Marcia Davis, the Deputy Commissioner, DOR, Michael Williams, economist, and acting division our director is Mr. Kevin Banks. One of these days we're going to get rid of that acting part. In any event, we appear it will take about 2 hours today, and hopefully, you know, set some expectations as we go forward to how we can mature this conversation with two goals in mind. Well, actually three: educating all of us further on where we are and where we're going in respect to gas taxes, setting a window of when we are going to address gas taxes, to with the objective, if there has to be some modifications, to do that. And in that respect, I think we will begin that conversation now. Please, put yourself on the record.
Senator Huggins, my name is Marcia Davis, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Revenue. And I thank you for inviting us here today. It's a great opportunity to launch the issue and the topic of gas commercialization, and certainly as a starting point as you guys begin to consider a lot of information that's going to be coming down the pike, both under the AGEA license process as well as any other types of information that you solicit as alternatives or other information to.
Yeah, we can't hear back in the room, so if you move your mic a little bit.
Sorry. Okay. I normally talk too loud, so. Today we do have three folks to give presentations, including myself. And by way of introduction, I think it is absolutely appropriate to start with the letter that Senator Huggins wrote back in March of 2007 when we first began considering gas commercialization with the GEA before us. That was essentially our context at that point in time when the letter was written. But as I look at it today and go back and look at what our answers are and the fuller kind of picture behind those, I think it's interesting that it presaged a lot of issues that we have now or that are, I would say, crux issues. So it was a letter that had a lot of good focus back then, and it's kept that focus today. At the time of the letter, obviously AGEA was under consideration, and the issue was locking in a gas tax during an open season, and concern was expressed about, well, if we're going to do that, should we do it now? Should we take care of gas tax now? And the recommendation that was ultimately accepted was to push ahead with a tax system that focused on oil, understanding that the gas part of it would have to be revisited and retooled if necessary, so that it was the right structure. The other thing that's interesting is that it also the letter also had a focus, which was all of our focus at that time, which is Alaska competitive? Are we competitive? And because we didn't want our fiscal system to be the piece that stopped a viable gas project. Under the law, the other thing the letter mentioned was concern that oil and gas were being treated the same. And because we had not yet dealt with ACEs, the conclusion had not yet been reached as to whether or not we were going to be going with a gross tax, a net tax, in terms of any changes coming on. Obviously, we were sitting there at the time with PPT, which treated oil and gas the same. And I think that's why Senator Huggins raised it as a question. Is that still appropriate? Do we still want to treat oil and gas the same? And by virtue of ACES, we continue to treat oil and gas the same because we did park the issue of gas taxation during the debate regarding the changes in confirming the changes that we would stick with the net system. Finally, the letter also asked about...
Marcia, let me ask you just for a baseline of the conversation to bring everybody up to level. What is the current tax rate for gas?
Current tax rate for gas is 25%,
right.
The same as for oil, a base tax.
And that was upped during the special session, is that correct?
No, it was 22.5
right.
during PPT, and and now currently under ACES, it was upped along with oil to 25%.
Right. So we had a 22.5. We have now raised gas rates in the intermediate since we talked during the normal session. And in that respect, many people have asked me, and I'm unable to answer them, why do we raise gas taxes?
And that's a good question. What we did is we essentially raised oil taxes and chose not to examine at that time the whether that rate was perfect or not for gas, because
right.
we knew that we were going to be needing to revisit the issue of gas taxes and in the context of a gas project. And one of the challenges that we had and we expressed during the ACES debate was that in order to have a refined tax that incentivized the investment we wanted to see, that rewarded the types of economic behaviors we wanted to see happen, and that resulted in a fair economic sharing between the state and the industry in the context of gas, we needed to know more about what that gas project was going to be. We needed to have a clear understanding of the type of project, because what you might do if you realize you're going to be shooting for an LNG project versus an overland gas pipeline project might be very different things and might have different economic drivers. And we know that this legislature is very, very concerned about fiscal stability, about not going in and being seen to tinker and change repeatedly the tax laws. So in honor of that strong desire, we want to essentially, when we're ready, make the change to gas, do it once, do it right, and lock it in. And it is absolutely accurate to say that the time is coming, that we are, you know, all the different kind of dates and timings are coming to bear here very, very shortly. We are at the kind of the beginning of the vortex on making that type of analysis and coming up with that decision. But at the time of ACES being passed, it wasn't so much a decision to increase tax on gas as it was to increase tax on oil and defer the discussion and the analysis for gas for when we did it once and did it right.
Yeah, one follow-up. But we did raise gas taxes, so we did work. Was there any discussion prior to the introduction of legislation in special session to de-link gas from oil?
There had been, absolutely, Senator Huggins. When we first began our analysis of how to, before we even drafted what became ACES, we were busy doing separate economic analyses of gas and of oil, and I'll be able to show you some of the work that we did in terms of the backgrounds that we have, and we've got good research on hand that will inform the legislature as they begin this next round. But at the time, because we didn't know if we were going to do a net or a gross tax as we developed it, we were looking at both. And when it became clear that a gross tax was not going to get us there economically and structurally for both the industry and the state, we ended up with a net system. And once you're in a net system, the challenge is that you have is if you make a distinction in the gas tax rate between oil and gas, or if you make a distinction in the progressivity formula between oil and gas, you force yourself into having to make two separate calculations. Once you're there, you now have the job and the responsibility of having to allocate costs in a field such as Prudhoe, where you have to say how much of this is associated with making gas, how much of these costs and equipment are associated with making oil, which becomes a very large challenge. Our discussion about auditors and needing staff would have been a much bigger one last go around if we had landed there in that session. So our goal was to not have to obviously deal with that if we could avoid it. So there are a lot of reasons why we ended up not segregating and just simply treating them differently.
Right. And then going forward on the gas pipeline, we had multiple applications. One was deemed conforming. Is that accurate?
Yes, as of the initial review.
One's being reconsidered.
Yeah, one is under reconsideration.
Right. Do you think, or do you have any indication that the lack of fiscal stability or certainty had bearing on applications?
Senator Huggins, I personally don't have that information or that sense of it. However, I will put a caveat that I personally have been fully engaged with the team that's been working to implement ACES, the regulations and workshops, et cetera, and we've sort of divided labor, so I have not been sitting in the what I'll call the AGEA work team that did that review and that analysis.
Yeah. Okay. But we're interested beyond your, I mean,
oh, sure.
The administration, if you have that information.
Senator, you bet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So two questions. Question one is, what is the administration's perspective on the appropriate time to do this gas change? That's number one. Should we do it this session? Should we wait till next year, before open season, after open season, presumably before open season? And then question number two is, could you please address the what we're hearing from some of the producers, in particular ConocoPhillips, where they've said they want to sit down with the administration. They want to work out a tax structure for the next 20, 25 years. And if you could just give us the administration's perspective on whether you intend to do that, whether you think that's the best course for the state to take, whether that should be done in negotiations with the governor, or whether that should be something that is done openly legislatively.
Mm-hmm. Senator Wachowski, through the chair, as to the first question, we think beginning the discussion about gas tax now is certainly not inappropriate. I mean, we do need to continue to connect to where we've been, to where we need to go. Clearly, the idea that the gas tax is going to be locked in at open season is for 10 years. And let me put a little caveat on that. We're locking it in for 10 years if that's what that taxpayer wants. Obviously, if we were to change the tax law to be more beneficial, that provision allows for a taxpayer to opt into the change if they want. So it doesn't restrict us from making further improvements or refinements to the gas tax, but certainly it affects what a producer would analyze or evaluate or put into their consideration when they approach an open season and decide whether to tender their gas. So I'm not downplaying the importance of having our what we think is our best tax structure in place at open season. So with respect to that, I think that drives our timing. And so we need to back up from there and have a belief that our system needs to be well thought out, well analyzed, and put in place before that point in time. It's my understanding from, you know, bids, the one qualifying bid, that there was an expectation, a hope of holding an open season in 18 months. We feel that to do the tax now would be premature because we don't even know if that bidder will end up being the successful licensee. So ideally, we probably need to get through this session to decide what the gas pipeline goal is for this legislature and what its structure is, and then with very sharp knives and, you know, forks and everything else, dive into the information that we will have collected and decide what is the optimum structure for gas and get that in place probably at the next legislative session. At least start that dialogue. That's ideal. Right now, I would feel very hamstrung and ill-equipped to prepare this body with the information they need to arrive at the wisest and best choice for a gas tax structure if I don't know if it's going to be LNG, if I don't know if it's going to be a gas overland, if I don't know, you know, is there going to be an in-state component to it? There are a lot of pieces that you want to do well, and I really do feel strongly that we need to honor the principle that we give stability and certainty to the industry so that when we act surely, we do it, and we leave it alone. So I think that all seems to be driving toward next legislative session, but with a lot of work between now and then. On your second question, Senator Wilikowski, I'm trying to remember now, it was about the ConocoPhillips bid and its request for fiscal certainty. Again, I think I'll have to take a bit of a caveat because I have not been in the group sitting and evaluating the ConocoPhillips bid or not bid, but their proposal. And but I do know that from our perspective, we have a gas tax, and we are talking about making refinements to that gas tax. As far as fiscal certainty, I haven't heard any flesh on the bones yet in terms of kind of what ConocoPhillips is looking for, whether they're looking for certainty as far as time frame, a longer time frame, shorter time frame, whether they want that time frame more secure. From their perspective, I know there was a lot of debate during the passage of a GIA about whether or not one legislature could bind a future legislature with respect to locking in tax rates and tax terms. And I understand there are some bills being proposed in this legislative session to attempt to deal with that. We do know that from the time of the Stranded Gas Act negotiations, we know what fiscal certainty meant in that time frame. And as I recall, I think Econ 1 analyzed the fiscal certainty that was requested or required by the three producers at that time as being something that had a price tag of roughly $3 billion. So there's a lot of import to what ConocoPhillips could possibly mean by fiscal certainty. It could range from anywhere as simple as lock in what you have, just give us certainty, or it could go all the way to a wide range to the extreme of maybe what we saw during the Stranded Gas negotiations. So what those details are, we don't know yet. And also, it's my understanding ConocoPhillips has made this proposal, but has said in order for it to truly fly, they're going to have to bring in BP and Exxon. So what ConocoPhillips finds satisfactory as fiscal certainty may not be what Exxon finds acceptable as fiscal certainty. So there's a lot to work through as a legislature, you know, obviously may be considering that and looking at it and understanding it. So you'll have a good opportunity to ask those questions. But we haven't, and we'll be interested to hear as well as you what they mean.
Again, Resources Committee would like to welcome Senator Ellis, Senator Dyson, Senator Thomas, Representative Seaton. Did I miss anybody out there? Good. Ah, yes. And our good friend from Juneau. Welcome. You jumped to ConocoPhillips, which brings to mind to me that people ask me when we talk about gas taxes, they say, well, you, and some say, well, you're just working for the producers. And my innate feeling is that whomever's going to build the gas pipeline is the biggest beneficiary to setting the tax rate, the tax regime in Alaska, because it starts some certainty factors when they're trying to get the financing and to get commitments for gas. Otherwise, it creates a major uncertainty for them in a number of areas, one of which is the financial risk and the state shares in that burden. Do you concur or not in my thought process?
Senator Huggins, certainly stability in a marketplace aids all participants in that market, no doubt. The buyer, the seller, the ultimate consumers. We have a tax, and when we go through it, we're going to show you that, in fact, under ACES, with the tax that we have in place, notwithstanding that the base tax rate went from 22.5% to 25% on the gas tax along with the oil, the way that progressivity works, there is a huge, and I'll say, you know, potentially huge incentive for owners of gas to get going and sell their gas at the same time they're selling their oil. And so the base tax is one piece of the picture. There's another piece. So right now that is the law. So I guess your starting point will be to assess where we are today, not only the base tax, but this progressivity kick. Decide, once you know what project you're looking at, is that a sufficient incentive or not? And if not, tweak it some more. But clearly, where we sit today is not a bad place from our perspective, and it's not a bad place when you look at it with reference to a gas project moving forward today. What more we might need to do remains to be seen. But as far as certainty, there is certainty. This is the tax law. It isn't changing yet. And this legislative body will have an opportunity to decide if it wants to change it more. But certainly, I wouldn't disagree with the premise that not only a ConocoPhillips builder of a pipeline, but also a TransCanada, you know, an independent third party, would want certainty and stability when it approaches an open season, because its marketplace needs to be confident as well.
And let me just cut through very quickly and ask you the macro question. In your professional opinion, based on what you know thus far, are gas taxes generally about right, too high, or too low?
In a macro view,
right,
we are stacking up middle of the pack as far as international competitive rates on fiscal terms. But as we learned last go-around, the fiscal term is only one piece of the picture. You also have to take into account the geology. You know, what are our rocks like? You know, what's our gas resource like? You have to take a look at the cost to market, the development, the transportation costs. You have to look at what the pricing of the commodity is going to be over the time frame you're looking at bringing your product in. So those variables affect, you know, how well we sit today. But if you look at strictly the fiscal system that we have, the terms that we have under our tax and our royalty, when we assess those in a macro view, we're about middle of the pack.
Okay. When then you factor in delivery of our gas to market, what happens? I mean, I don't think you can do it sterilely.
That's more challenging. That's the robust discussion you're going to have when you start to look at the TransCanada proposal and the full economics of that, looking at ConocoPhillips or anyone else that would come in. That full market from the rock all the way down into the marketplace with the transportation costs, with the time frame for the commodity pricing we're looking at, that's the piece that I don't have rolled up in my noggin right now, but we should be able to get pretty well fleshed out during this session.
Okay, thank you. Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, just there's an argument made by some of the producers that they would like to sit down with the administration and work this out, work out negotiations. I think we've heard Conoco say that. They want to sit down with you and work out a tax plan. Can you give me the administration's perspective on that, whether that's acceptable to you, whether or you think there's a different course of action that should be taken on that?
The last I heard was that that had been tried, it was unsuccessful, and the goal here was to work hand-in-hand with the legislators to deliver terms, fiscal terms in the form of tax and royalty and any other incentives that were built into the system, and that we wanted to break it open and widen the opportunity for all comers to have a shot at building our gas pipeline. And that, I believe, is still the position.
Okay, and joining Representative Seaton, Representative Curtula, now is Representative Hawker. Welcome.
One of the key lessons learned last go-around in terms of trying to understand how competitive we were when we looked at oil was that we figured out there were some guiding principles that were shared by both the legislature and the administration. And those were that the state must not give away resource value beyond that which is necessary and beyond that which would deliver an even greater economic value to the state. So we have to be intelligent in how we manage the resources and make sure that, one, that what we give away has value to the industry that's receiving it so that it makes a difference and incentivizes their behavior, and two, is right-sized. I mean, we're not giving away so much that we've essentially been an inefficient buyer in the marketplace, so to speak. So to do that, however, requires a lot of information. It requires us to know the business, perhaps as well as industry. And that was our goal in ACES. A key part, the part that was closest to my heart, was the need to get more information so that we were a better negotiator and actually a better partner with the producers. So having looked at those principles, we understand that in order to get the gas tax right, if it's not right now, how to change it, we need to know about the rocks, we need to know about the costs, the transportations, et cetera, and we need to understand how our fiscal terms stack up against other countries' fiscal terms. And that breaks in nicely to our other speakers. Kevin Banks with Department of Natural Resources is going to speak briefly to the geology, to the resource, to the gas resource, what it looks like, and from DNR's perspective, you know, how we sit today. Second speaker is Dr. Michael Williams, who's our chief economist, who's going to speak to the transportation costs, the commodity pricing, the global pressures, and the North American pressures on the gas. And this will, I think, give you a really good footing from which you can be grounded and begin to ask questions and make inquiries about the pipeline projects you're going to hear about. And finally, I'm going to basically provide information about how our fiscal terms are stacking up compared to the international large projects that we're seeing out on the horizon, as well as what I'll call tax and royalty countries. Because again, one of the things we learned is it's a challenge comparing ourselves with our systems, and we want to kind of make sure we're comparing apples and apples at times. So we'll have both of those. And finally, I want to share with you the impact, the significant economic impact of the progressivity calculation when it's applied to an oil and gas sales compared to just an oil sale. So with that, I'd like to invite Mr. Banks.
Okay, thank you. And we're going to take a brief at ease so we can do some technical fixes.
And I think we need it for him to get his slides
up. Right. You're
going to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kevin Banks, and I am still the acting director of the Division of Oil and Gas. Nominations for Golden Globes and Emmys will be.
How many years of service you have?
I've worked for the state since 1991.
Oh, very good. Well, congratulations. Thank you.
Well, it's always a pleasure to address this committee, and I also wanted, if you'll indulge me for a minute, to say just it's also a pleasure to share a table with people as smart as Marcia Davis and to follow on people like Kathy Forrester. Today what I'd like to do is kind of merge my discussion with the one you heard yesterday from Commissioner Forrester and elaborate a bit on a few of the points that she made, and also try to draw a distinction between the economic and development parameters that surround the reservoir at Prudhoe Bay, the Point Thompson Reservoir, and to look a little bit at the exploration potential and how that figures in. I think what I'd like to come to is to illustrate that in terms of the impact of a fiscal regime on gas, we have a wider distribution of individual kinds of issues to deal with respect to the type of development that we're going to be trying to incentivize. And given that, the challenge will be to create a system that works for these widely different kinds of situations. I also have a very brief commercial in the middle of my talk, and then I'll talk a bit about incentives that we now have in place for gas development, both in the rules that govern royalties, redress a few or repeat a few comments about the PPT ACES tax incentives, and then mention a few things about AGEA. So with that, let's take a look at our resource potential. You've seen numbers like this before, I'm sure. These represent the mean estimates of potential undiscovered resources in the North Slope, both onshore and offshore. And like I said, you've heard these numbers before. They move around a bit as studies are done and completed. Keep in mind that these are mean numbers, which is a mathematical representation of a distribution. And so normally what geologists are concerned about is, in addition to what is the sort of this point of central tendency in a mean, they're also interested in the tails. So we look at this distribution at a 5% probability of success. You'd expect to be at fairly high numbers. At a 95% probability, the numbers are going to be quite low. In other words, the sure things are a smaller predictor of resource. But in fact, you can only add together the means. So when we were working on this slide, I struck out those other two because they're, you can capture all of the information you need by just looking at the this center tendency. But it also means that there is some range of values that surround each of these numbers. Having said that, these are not the numbers that that Kathy Forrester was referring to when she was talking about reserves. These are undiscovered, technically recoverable, given today's technologies, but it doesn't address the question of economics. And I've seen some estimates, and I hope we'll be able to share them with you someday, that coming from the federal government that suggests that perhaps about half of these resources may be economically recoverable. But mind you, they're still undiscovered, so there's a probability that they may never be found or that we may find more than is listed on that table. In this table, this is what Kathy Forrester was referring to as the developed and undeveloped reserves. I've chosen to call them known reserves to avoid getting into too much of a semantic argument about what the SEC might call a reserve or what an engineer might refer to. But basically, this represents the potential of gas that has been already discovered, and in most cases, with the exception of the 8T under known undeveloped, represents our best estimate of what kind of gas are in the reservoirs that are now producing, or soon to be producing, in the case of Ugarit. I might also add that I think perhaps in discussions I've had with Michael Williams, there is an SEC reserve estimate that has been put up by the producers. It's a number that is considerably lower than this 35. It's, I think Michael Williams told me it was close to 9 or something by his estimate. And that represents gas that is nearer to some kind of development capability. And I suspect that is a that number hasn't changed since the late 80s, and so it must represent a definition issue with respect to how SEC wants people to show gas reserves on their balance sheets. In fact, yesterday,
excuse me, if I might, though, on the physical part of how much gas is actually there, that's not a dispute. It's in definition. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay.
It's a matter of semantics. What I was going to also say is that yesterday Commissioner Forrester was talking about SEC reserves and how the FERC will treat those. I believe it's something of a chicken and the egg kind of issue. At an open season, a pipeline company, no matter who it is, who is seeking tendering for gas is going to want their suppliers or their customers, their shippers, to be able to back up a commitment for gas to supply the pipeline. That supplier need not have all of the gas that it might take over a period of, say, 20 years, if that's what the commitment requirements are. It depends on the strength of the company and the company's capability of perhaps discovering gas later on. The kind of economic stature of the company is really important. And the FERC is very interested that bar for those kinds of characteristics is not set so high that the competition for space in the pipeline at an open season isn't somehow interfered with. So there's this balance that the FERC has to strike when examining an application and certifying a pipeline, that the open season was sufficiently competitive, and then of course the pipeline owner and the FERC wants to make sure that the commitments made for those kinds of shipping commitments are sufficiently underwritten both by gas and the balance sheet of the company that there's their customer. Now, with that, I'd like to enter into a discussion of the Prudhoe Bay unit, the Point Thompson unit, and expiration potential on the North Slope. Now, I for the benefit of some of those that I know I will be talking to in the next few days after giving this talk, some of the adjectives I put in here are intended to draw out the distinctions between each of these examples, and keep in mind that things kind of are blurrier than we can get into in a presentation like this. But for example, Prudhoe Bay is a reservoir that is pretty well understood. It's already developed. There's a lot of infrastructure in place. And gas investments, the investments it'll take to deliver gas to a gas treatment plant and subsequently to a pipeline, are mostly in place now. Obviously, there would be some investments required in the field, but relatively speaking, that's not going to be a very large part of the problem that we need to examine when trying to decide what the cost structure and looking at the kinds of fiscal terms and the disincentives and incentives that may play out in a unit like this. There is a challenge that we have to face, and we see that happening already. The operators at Prudhoe Bay have already begun upgrading the facilities, installing new kinds of control equipment. Obviously, maintenance has been a discussion, but it's extremely important that the facilities that are already there go through a routine and regular maintenance and upgrade. And as Commissioner Forrester said, again, she wanted to see aggressive development of the oil so that when a gas sale finally does occur, we can minimize the oil loss. And also, I mean, that basically says that each time there's some failure in the systems up there and the flow of oil is interrupted, that's oil that is the opposite of aggressively being developed. That's oil that is pushing out the timeliness of a sale in some respects. The risks of reservoir risks and the potential of the resource or the reserves there is relatively low. Obviously, I imagine, and if you'll forgive me, I bet we've seen every molecule of methane that's inside of the reservoir at least once or twice over the last several years as it's been cycled through the facilities to maintain reservoir pressure and for enhanced oil recovery. Because the pipeline will begin near the Prudhoe Bay unit, it will have the highest netback value. Now, having said that, that's not a particularly, in the scheme of things, the difference in netback values between Prudhoe Bay, Point Thompson, and other units is not one of the most important issues. It is an issue, however, to keep in mind. Gas, of course, much of the market value is eaten up by transportation, and which is another factor that we have to take into account when talking about fiscal systems for gas. At Point Thompson, go ahead.
If we could go back just a moment. Bullet number three, you know, I use an analogy, a hunting analogy, a shooting analogy.
Mm-hmm.
My father grew up shooting my grandfather's 1911 Winchester, which was made on a Browning patent. And I still shoot my father's humpback Auto 5, which is made on that same Browning patent. And Browning has a provision where you can send it back and have it redone, and they'll put choke tubes in it. I mean, all the modern innovations. And it's good, and it works very well. And it looks shiny when you get it back, but it's expensive to have that done. It's like buying a new gun. My assumption that bullet number three has some of those same attributes, this business of maintaining and upgrading so that it works as well in 2010 as it did 20 years ago or 30 years ago, is expensive. Am I on the mark on that, or am I?
No, I don't want to minimize it, but of course it is. I don't know that it is as expensive as developing the field from scratch. And
that certainly is not my point.
But, and that's here again, this is the kind of distinction I want to make between a field like Prudhoe Bay versus a field like
No, I understand. I mean, that's apples and oranges. I mean, there's no doubt in order of merit, if you're starting from scratch, it's more expensive because you got to buy the stuff with inflationary cost.
I drive a Subaru that is also extremely expensive to maintain because it's very old. And so I understand the point. At Point Thompson, here again, this is one of those adjectives that I'm sure people are cringing in the back room about minimal exploration risk. I mean, here again, I'm trying to make a distinction with Prudhoe Bay. The reservoir at Point Thompson has been penetrated many times, and we have a fairly good idea about the extent of the reservoir. We also know something about the oil potential in other zones within the unit area, and but we don't know everything that we need to know, and that's where, although there's some minimal, if you will, risk of finding gas and oil there and having a reasonably good estimate of what kind of potential we may have there in terms of development, there still are many challenges that need to be addressed. You heard yesterday that the high pressure of the reservoir means that although the technology may be off the shelf, you'll be shopping on Rodeo Drive for it and not at Target. It's expensive equipment. None of the wells that have been drilled in Point Thompson have flowed, so there is major questions about how the reservoir will perform when under different production techniques. We heard about those challenges yesterday, and so I can expect that an appropriate development scenario would be that there would be a few more exploration wells drilled that may not be completed to as production wells. There may be a need to drill production wells in a kind of to test technologies, to test the performance of the reservoir before moving on to a full-scale development of the reservoir. This is true for most of the undeveloped resources and undiscovered resources on the North Slope. There is a very large component related to delineating this field and testing and developing the techniques to finally go into full development. The last point is perhaps obvious, but it is and it will apply to most of the undiscovered resources on the North Slope as well, is that oil production will bear some of the cost, and in fact, because of the value of oil, it may be able to afford it more than the gas. On exploration, we have very high exploration risk, in part for the same reasons that Point Thompson is. There's still questions about what the resources are like. In the case where Anadarko is drilling in Gubik and their Chandler prospects on the western side of our central North Slope, they're drilling into an area where gas resources have been discovered already, but the age of those tests and those wells are so old that basically Anadarko, while it knows it's drilling for gas, needs to apply more modern drilling and techniques and drilling tests to assess the potential of that reservoir. And furthermore, it gets it back into that delineation issue in the long lead time. This will be true for most exploration, where a substantial sum of money will have to be spent, at the end of which you may not have a developable resource. You may have come to the conclusion after spending a considerable amount of money that it really is not a commercially viable prospect. So that long team lead time is an important issue.
Your experience in that as an economist in Alaska, substantial. And what does that mean? Give us some round numbers that would fall into. And you're describing unsuccessful potentially.
Well, I mean,
or it could be successful.
Well, point is that you're stepping through gates.
Right.
So I've heard the exploration wells. I've heard numbers in the order of $40 million apiece just for exploration. You get into the next step, where there has to be more infrastructure in place as well as more drilling that occurs, and we're into the hundreds of millions of dollars at that point, even after which there could be a decision not to proceed to the next step, which would be full development. So it gives you an assessment of the scale of the problem. Now, I might add that the net tax system that we've adopted goes a long way to help incentivize the explorers, and I think that's to our credit, we stepped back into the net tax system, recognizing that that was going to be the result, and I appreciate that as a DNR person that we have at our disposal incentive credits and the potential for credits for investment.
Note, I just want to commend Deputy Commissioner Davis for having some leadership in the business of the net tax system. I know that was a sort of a 180-degree switch in the tone of conversation by some, but I say thank you for doing that because I think it'll serve Alaska well.
On transportation infrastructure, because most of the exploration prospects that will be developed over the next several years may not be ready for the initial open season, we can expect that assurances of access on the main line and the potential for expansion, even before construction begins, is important for our early explorers, so they have an opportunity to get in on get their resource monetized, get it to market. So that is an important feature of the gas line. Just underscoring the point again, the fact that most of these resources will have to be touched by some kind of upstream pipeline means that the netback value will be lower than it is at Prudhoe Bay. Obviously, you have more tariffs to pay, and so you're already low netback, or maybe said a different way, the proportion of the market value that goes to delivering the product to the market is exacerbated for our explorationists. Now for the commercial, just a couple of slides on reservoir modeling. Yesterday, we heard about the modeling efforts that the AOGCC has conducted together with BP as the operator at Prudhoe Bay, and the Division of Oil and Gas is also stepping into more direct and independent modeling. And part of the reason for that is twofold. Number one is the AOGCC's relationship with the industry is slightly different, and I think their ability to acquire the kinds of information they have may be more leveraged, if for lack of another word, than what DNR's may be. The other reason for doing this kind of modeling independently is that there is before I get to it, let me go to this next slide and talk a little bit about how the alternative uses of gas are important to us. And then I'll come back to my second point here. Gas, as you've heard already, is used for fuel injection and enhanced oil recovery. It will also be used for oil and viscous oil development projects, and a huge resource is potential there. And then finally, it'll be exported to in-state and out-state markets through the pipeline. So the state needs to examine not just the performance of gas within a single reservoir. It needs to take a look and see just how gas will fit into a whole host of different applications. And so it's our desire at DNR to address those kinds of issues and try to optimize the modeling effort. And in particular, gas is now sold, as you probably know, to other units out of Prudhoe Bay and is being used in other reservoirs for enhanced oil recovery and pressure maintenance, for example, at North Star. Because the ownership of a reservoir at Prudhoe Bay may be very different than the ownership of another reservoir, I'm not sure that our scope of the problem is different than what the scope of the problem that is usually treated in a reservoir modeling exercise by the by the operator at Prudhoe Bay. We have a wider spectrum of issues that we want to examine. And I think for that reason, having an independent view of these reservoirs is extremely important.
Senator Wagner.
Kevin, that gas that's being taken from Prudhoe, for instance, and used in other reservoirs, what is the prognosis on the retrieval of that gas after its use? I know in on the peninsula, for instance, we've had pretty poor results of retrieving the gas that was put into Swanson River, for instance, for pressurization for oil recovery.
Well, I can sort of describe the problem by describing a couple of examples. The large-scale EOR project at Kuparik has built into it agreements with us about how gas will be lifted out of Prudhoe Bay. It will bear a royalty and then is re-injected into the Kuparik oil field. And we've actually deemed a number for how much of that gas will be lost. This is miscible injectant. Mostly it's gas liquids. And there's just a certainty that some amount of that gas will not be produced again. And then, of course, we've got an accounting arrangement in this agreement to make sure that the operators aren't paying twice for the same gas that's produced. In an example like North Star, where it's mostly a pressure maintenance issue, more of that gas will be recovered. Because it's more of a lean gas kind of project. I think I'm saying that right. So it the answer is it depends, but I think in your example in the Kenai, it's injecting gas into a very huge reservoir at the oil and gas reservoir at Swanson River, and so as a consequence, it's like filling up your spare tire with a bicycle pump. You certainly have to pump awfully hard to get up to 35 psi. You don't have to pump so far in a bicycle tire. Okay, now I'll touch upon the incentives that we have in place now and which could be used to enhance gas economic development. On the royalty side and administered by the DNR is our royalty modification statute that allows for a 5% royalty rate or dropping the lease rate to as low as 5% for an undeveloped field. And so the best example of that is the Nikaichuk project or the Ugarik project, where we have awarded royalty relief. And
for the benefit of the viewers, would you just give us a number for what the standard royalty rate is?
At the moment, the lease rate, I think, at Pioneer's Ugarik is at 5%. If there were production, well, neither one of them are in production, but at today's prices, the royalty rate at Nikaichuk would be the lease rate because it's triggered at a lower price than today. Sure, and Marsh is whispering to be sure that you understand that most of the leases in these both of these fields are at 12.5% or 16 2/3%.
So that's the baseline number that we generally speak of.
Right.
When we're talking about the rate.
Right. And
just for a moment to recognize that we've been joined by Senator French. Welcome.
Okay. And the other point I wanted to make about this particular statute is that the applicant must provide the state with a clear and convincing showing that the royalty modification, it will be, as I put it, efficient and effective. In other words, it has to work. It has to change behavior. But it also can't be a situation where no matter how much royalty relief you gave, the economics still wouldn't create a situation that for an economic development. Slipping quickly into ACEs.
If we might, just
sure.
a couple of questions on royalty. prior to 2006, how many royalty reliefs had we done, roughly speaking?
Zero.
Zero. And how many did we do in 2007?
One and one in 06. So in at the beginning of 06, we awarded the Ugaruk royalty modification, and we have just last week had a final best interest finding to issue royalty relief at Nikaichuk.
Okay. And could you just give us an overview of what that looked like, that relief?
What it looks like?
Yeah. And what the rationale was?
Yes, sir. In the Ugaruk case, if I can recall, the idea was to provide royalty relief until, on a sliding scale based on price, until the unit was in payout. We actually have a net profit share lease in the unit. We will be measuring the economics of the project through time, and at some point the project will reach payout. In other words, it will have recovered its capital costs, and it will be earning more than its operating costs, and the state will share in those profits. And then after that point, the royalty rate will creep back up to the lease rate. In the case of Nikaichuk, we have provided downside relief or protection by offering royalty relief at 5% when the price falls, market price for ANS falls below $42 or thereabouts, adjusted for inflation. So that's just an on and off switch for the Nikaichuk project.
Right. Do you have other requests for royalty relief presently in staffing?
There have been discussions for royalty relief in the Cook Inlet. I'm not sure of the status of that. No formal application has been made to us, nor have I heard of anything else on the North Slope.
Yeah.
As of yet, I don't know that we have any project that is mature enough to get to that clear and convincing showing standard for applying for it.
Thank you.
ACES and PPT, we've been through just recently, so this will be a very brief refresher. Tax credits apply for the qualified CapEx, for exploration credits, and then also the loss carry forward credit of 25%, where in fact the state participates to some extent in the commodity risk of the product of the resource. So here again, going back to the fact that much of the or a large slice of the market value is eaten up by transportation, there is a potential, I suppose, that the price at some point in time or occasionally could fall below zero at a net back. To the extent that there is an opportunity to count that as a loss, the state will bear or be willing to provide a loss carry forward of 25% over a couple of years. There is obviously the issue of net present value problems that the state is giving up a little. It helps the companies a lot in that case. Also, we have now established in ACES, which I think from my point of view a very important issue, the tax credit fund, so that the applicants for exploration credits will enjoy 100% of the credit that they apply for, rather than some discount off the full value when they had to sell it to others. There's, of course, the $12 million credit for small producers, and that really will apply in some cases to new people coming into the state. And then let's not forget that we will tax, cap the tax at 17 cents per MCF for in-state gas sales. Parsing out what that 17 cents per MCF is a challenge, because we measure the tax rate and the tax charge on a BOE, barrel oil equivalent basis. And then lastly, the point that Marcia just touched on, and I will simply tee up here, is that gas sales for oil producers will lower the oil tax rate. And so, frankly, you can apply that benefit to the gas. To illustrate that, take a look at this chart. The effective tax is listed in blue. This is treating our net tax as a gross tax in this particular analysis, so that you can see at $90, oil tax rate would be something in excess of 32% of the total revenue to the taxpayer. When blending the price of gas on a barrel of oil equivalent into the mix of calculating the progressivity charge and the kinds of margin you look to, because the margin is determined on an average basis, on an average BOE basis, and because the price of gas is so much lower than the price of oil on an energy basis, that you've effectively reduced the tax rate for oil by adding gas to a gas sale. Marcia will be giving you, I should say, Commissioner Davis will be providing you an arithmetical example of this that I think will make it crystal clear what we're trying to illustrate here. But it is a very significant and substantial benefit that is embedded in ACES today. And lastly, a couple of points on AGEA. We offered a tax certainty for 10 years for gas committed to the initial open season. We are willing to establish a royalty valuation methodology that is different than what is in the lease now and which is arguably today complicated.
Could you provide us a copy with that?
Of this slide, sir? No.
You said an enhanced regime.
When we get to it, yes.
Oh, you haven't done that yet?
No. That we will be developing regulations to that effect as we continue.
But you have some model, right? I mean, how it works, or before you do regulations, I assume.
Anyway, if it's available,
we'd like a copy of it.
When it's done, we'll hand it right over. You can bet on it. There were some. We had begun working on it under SGDA and as part of discussions with the producers. We have a notion of where we want to take it, and before we roll it out, we certainly will share it with you and try to get as much input as we can from everyone who's going to be looking at it. Obviously, we want it to work. And lastly, on the royalty side, we're willing to modify our rights to switch from royalty in kind to royalty value and back again to provide some certainty, and so that the taxpayer or a royalty payer in this case suffers no stranded or insufficient capacity. And then lastly, under AGEA, I touched on this just briefly, the opportunity for expansion and access to the pipeline and terms that are designed to assure rolled in rates, capital structure that should contribute to a should contribute to low tariffs, and as well the $500 million contribution that we make very early on in the project has a fairly sizable impact on the tariff that will be that our explorers will be seen, and for that matter, anyone committing gas to the pipeline will see. So that does it for me, sir, on my slide.
Kevin, thank you very much. Good presentation. A question for you is a flashback to what Ms. Forrester presented to us yesterday.
Yes.
And she mentioned about, the activity in the multiple fields, and then she mentioned very quickly sharing facilities.
Yes.
And how that we're essentially at 100% in the fields as far as activity, and whenever to get someone access, you have to vacate some of your. Could you just give us a 60-second burst? What the economics of that means to us?
Well, I'll try to put it this way: the gas-oil ratio of wells that are being produced out of a legacy field into those facilities may be very high. The gas-oil ratio of the production from a new field will be relatively low. So, in other words, we can use an example that was close to what I think Commissioner Forrester was talking about. Say 90% of the fluid out of a well in a legacy field is gas. You might have the flip, 10% of it coming out of a new field, is gas. Well, you have the makings, I think, of a commercial deal there, because you can back out a tenth of a barrel and get nine-tenths of a barrel in place of it. And so in addition to paying for, you know, whatever operating cost adjustments may apply, the back out means that the new oil coming in bears a lower cost impact to the owner of the facility. They have to back out their oil because it is it's running at capacity. But on the other hand, in losing a tenth of a barrel and paying for it with nine-tenths of a barrel, it certainly is possible that the person seeking facility access can find that they can afford that and afford it because it will cost less than building their own facility. So that's the way I view the economics of facility access.
Okay. It works. It can be done. And Pioneer appears to be the first to be close to being able to run the gauntlet on that.
That's my understanding. Yes, sir.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Questions for Kevin? Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Make it go away. Technological difficulty. I usually right click, you can get out of a PowerPoint.
Okay, let's take about a 5 minute.